She got into the black king knight on queen 2 for the 8th move, and then became bored with it. She had been moving the pieces too fast for analysis, not stopping herself as Benny would have made her do, to trace out everything that was going on. She finished the last spoonful of egg and went out the back door into the garden. It was a hot morning. The grass in the yard was overgrown. It nearly covered the little brick pathway that went to where some shabby tea roses stood. She went back into the house and played the white rook to queen 1, and then stared at it. She did not want to study chess. That was frightening. A vast amount of study lay ahead of her if she wanted to avoid humiliation in Moscow. She pushed down the fear and went upstairs for a shower. As she dried her hair, she saw with a kind of relief that she needed to have it cut. That would be something to do today. Afterward, she could go to Purcell's and look at sofas for the living room. But it wouldn't be wise to buy, not until she had more money. And how could she get the lawn mowed? A boy had done it for Mrs. Wheatley, but she didn't know his telephone number or address. She needed to clean up the place. There were cobwebs and messy-looking sheets and pillowcases. She could use some new ones. Some new clothes, too. Harry Beltic had left his razor in the bathroom. Should she mail it back? The milk had gone sour, and the butter was old. The freezer was full of ice crystals with a stack of old frozen chicken dinners stuck in the back. The bedroom rug was dusty, and the windows had fingerprints on the glass and grit on the sills. Beth shook the confusion out of her head as well as she could, and made an appointment with Roberta for a haircut at 2. She would ask where to find a cleaning woman for a few weeks. She would go to Morris's, order some chess books, and have lunch at Toby's. But her usual clerk wasn't at Morris's that day, and the woman who had replaced him knew nothing about ordering chess books. Beth managed to get her to find a catalog and ordered 3 on the Sicilian defense. She needed game books from Grandmaster Matches and Chess Informants, but she didn't know which Yugoslav press published Chess Informant, and neither did the new clerk. It was infuriating. She needed a library as good as Benny's. Better. Thinking of this, she finally realized angrily that she could go back to New York and forget all this confusion and continue with Benny from where she had left off. But what could Benny teach her now? What could any American teach her? She had moved past them all. She was on her own. She would have to bridge the gap herself that separated American chess from Russian. At Toby's, the head waiter knew her and put her at a good table near the front. She ordered asperge vinaigrette for an appetizer and told the waiter she would have that before ordering a main course.
"Would you care for a cocktail?"
he asked pleasantly. She looked around her at the quiet restaurant, at the people eating lunch, at the table with desserts near the velvet rope at the entrance to the dining room. "A Gibson," she said, "on the rocks." It came almost immediately. It was wonderful to look at. The tumbler was clear and clean. The gin inside was crystalline. The white onions were like 2 pearls. When she tasted it, it stung her upper lip, then stung her throat with a sweet tease as it went down. The effect on her tense stomach was remarkable. Everything about it was rewarding. She finished it slowly, and the deep fury in her began to subside. She ordered another. Back in the shadows at the far end of the room, someone was playing a piano. Beth looked at her watch. It was 11:45. It was good to be alive. She never got around to ordering the main course. She came out of Toby's at 2, squinting into the sunshine, and jaywalked across Main to David Manley's wine shop. Using 2 of her traveler's checks from Ohio, she bought a case of Palmasan Burgundy, 4 bottles of Gordon's gin, and a bottle of Martini and Rossi vermouth, and had Mr. Manley call her a taxi. Her speech was clear and sharp. Her gait was steady. She had eaten 6 stalks of asparagus and drunk 4 Gibsons. She had flirted with alcohol for years. It was time to consummate the relationship. The phone was ringing when she came in, but she did not answer it. The driver helped her with the case of wine, and she tipped him $1. When he had left, she got the bottles out one at a time and put them neatly into the cabinet over the toaster, in front of Mrs. Wheatley's old cans of spaghetti and chili. Then she opened a bottle of gin and twisted the cap off the vermouth. She had never made a cocktail before. She poured gin into the tumbler and added a little vermouth, stirring it with one of Mrs. Wheatley's spoons. She carried the drink carefully into the living room, sat down, and took a long swallow. The mornings were horrible, but she managed them. She went to Kroger's on the third day and bought 3 dozen eggs and a supply of TV dinners. After that, she always had 2 eggs before her first glass of wine. By noon, she had usually passed out. She would awake on the sofa or in a chair with her limbs stiff and the back of her neck damp with hot sweat. Sometimes, her head reeling, she would feel in the depth of her stomach an anger as intense as the pain of a burst abscess in the jaw, a toothache so potent that nothing but drink could alleviate it. Sometimes the drink had to be forced against a rejection of it by her body, but she did it. She would get it down and wait, and the feelings would subside a bit. It was like turning down the volume. On Saturday morning, she spilled wine on her kitchen chessboard, and on Monday, she bumped into the table by accident and sent some of the pieces falling to the floor. She left them there, picking them up only on Thursday, when finally the young man came by to mow the lawn. She lay on the sofa drinking from the last bottle in her case and listened to the roaring of his power mower, smelling the grass cuttings. When she had paid him, she went outside into the grass smell and looked at the lawn with its clumps of cuttings. It touched her to see it so altered, so changed from what it had been. She went back in, got her purse, and called a cab. The law did not permit deliveries of wine or liquor. She would have to get another case on her own. 2 would be smarter. And she would try Almaden. Someone had said Almaden Burgundy was better than Palmasson. She would try it. Maybe a few bottles of white wine, too. And she needed food. Lunches came from a can. The chili was pretty good if you added pepper and ate it with a glass of Burgundy. Almaden was better than Palmasson, less astringent on the tongue. The Gibsons, though, could hit her like a club, and she became wary of them, saving them until just before passing out, or sometimes for the first drink in the morning. By the third week, she was taking a Gibson up to bed with her on the night she made it upstairs to bed. She put it on the nightstand with a chess informant over it to keep the alcohol from evaporating, and drank it when she woke up in the middle of the night. Or if not then, in the morning, before going downstairs. Sometimes the phone rang, but she answered it only when her head and voice were clear. She always spoke aloud to check her level of sobriety before picking up the receiver. She would say, "Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers." And if it came out all right, she would take up the phone. A woman called from New York, wanting her on The Tonight Show. She refused. It wasn't until her third week of drinking that she went through the pile of magazines that had come while she was in New York and found the Newsweek with her picture in it. They had given her a full page under Sport. The picture showed her playing Benny, and she remembered the moment it was taken during the game's opening. The position of the pieces on the display board was visible in the photograph, and she saw that her memory was right. She had just made her fourth move. Benny looked thoughtful and distant as usual. The piece said she was the most talented woman since Vera Menchik. Beth, reading it half drunk, was annoyed at the space given to Menchik, going on about her death in a 1944 bombing in London, before pointing out that Beth was the better player. And what did being women have to do with it? She was better than any male player in America. She remembered the Life interviewer and the questions about her being a woman in a man's world. To hell with her. It wouldn't be a man's world when she finished with it. It was noontime, and she put a pan of canned spaghetti on to heat before reading the rest of the article. The last paragraph was the strongest. At 18, Beth Harmon has established herself as the queen of American chess. She may be the most gifted player since Morphy or Capablanca. No one knows just how gifted she is, how great a potential she holds in that young girl's body with its dazzling brain. To find out, to show the world if America has outgrown its inferior status in world chess, she will have to go where the big boys are. She will have to go to the Soviet Union. Beth closed the magazine and poured a glass of Almaden Mountain Chablis to drink with her spaghetti. It was 3 in the afternoon and hot as fury. And the wine was getting low. Only 2 more bottles stood on the shelf above the toaster. A week after reading the Newsweek article, she awoke on a Thursday morning too sick to get out of bed. When she tried to sit up, she couldn't. Her head and stomach were throbbing. She was still wearing her jeans and t-shirt from the night before, and she felt suffocated by them. But she could not get them off. The shirt was stuck to her upper body, and she was too weak to pull it over her head. There was a Gibson on the nightstand. She managed to roll over and take it with both hands, and she got half of it down before beginning to retch. For a moment, she thought she was choking, but her breath came back eventually, and she finished the drink. She was terrified. She was alone in that furnace of a room and frightened of dying. Her stomach was raw, and all of her organs hurt. Had she poisoned herself on wine and gin? She tried sitting up again, and with the gin in her, she managed it. She sat there for a few moments, calming herself, before she went unsteadily into the bathroom and vomited. It seemed to cleanse her. She managed to get her clothes off, and, afraid of slipping in the shower and breaking her hip the way unsteady old women did, she filled the tub with lukewarm water and took a bath. She should call McAndrews, Mrs. Wheatley's old doctor, and make an appointment for sometime around noon, if she could make it to his office. This was more than a hangover. She was ill. But downstairs, after her bath, she was steadier and got down 2 eggs with no difficulty. The thought of picking up the phone and calling someone seemed distant now. There was a barrier between herself and whatever world the phone would attach her to. She could not penetrate the barrier. She would be all right. She would drink less, taper off. Maybe she would feel like calling McAndrews after a drink. She poured herself a glass of Chablis and began sipping it. And it healed her like the magic medicine it was. The next morning, while she was eating breakfast, the phone rang and she picked it up without thinking. Someone named Ed Spencer was at the other end. It took a moment to remember that he was the local tournament director.
"It's about tomorrow," he said.
"Tomorrow?"
"The tournament. We wondered if you could come an hour early. The Louisville paper is sending a photographer, and we think WLEX will have somebody. Could you come in at 9?
Her heart sank. He was talking about the Kentucky State Championship. She had completely forgotten it. She was supposed to defend her title. She was supposed to go to Henry Clay High School tomorrow morning and begin a 2-day tournament as defending champion. Her head was throbbing, and her hand that held her coffee cup was unsteady.
"I don't know," she said. "Can you call back in an hour?"
"Sure, Miss Harmon."
"Thank you. I'll tell you in an hour."
She felt frightened, and she did not want to play chess. She had not looked at a chess book or touched her pieces since buying the house from Alston Wheatley. She did not want even to think about chess. Last night's bottle was still sitting on the counter next to the toaster. She poured half a glass, but when she drank it, it stung her mouth and tasted foul. She set the unfinished glass in the sink and got orange juice from the refrigerator. If she didn't clear her head and play the tournament, she would just be drunker tomorrow and sicker. She finished the orange juice and went upstairs, thinking of all the wine she had been drinking, remembering it in the pit of her stomach. Her insides felt fouled and abused. She needed a hot shower and fresh clothes. It would be a waste. Beltic wouldn't be in it, and there was no one else as good as he. Kentucky was nothing in chess. Standing naked in the bathroom, she started going through the Levin Fish variation of the Sicilian, squinting her eyes and picturing the pieces on an imaginary board. She did the first dozen moves without a mistake, although the pieces didn't stand out as clearly as they had a year before. She hesitated after move 18, where Black played pawn to knight 4 and got equality. Smyslov Botvinnik, 1958. She tried to play out the rest of it, but her head was aching, and after stopping to take 2 aspirin, she wasn't sure where the pawns were supposed to be. But she had gotten the first 18 moves right. She would stay sober today and play tomorrow. When she won the state championship for the 2nd time 2 years before, it had been simple. After herself and maybe Harry, there weren't any really strong players in Kentucky. Goldman and Sizemore were no problem. When the phone rang again, she told Ed Spencer she'd be there at 9:30. A half hour would be plenty of time for pictures. In the back of her mind, she had hoped Towns might show up with a camera, but there was no sign of him. The man from Louisville wasn't there either. She posed at board 1 for a woman photographer from the Herald Leader, did a 3-minute interview with a man from a local television station, and excused herself to go out for a walk around the block before the tournament began. She had managed to get through the day before without drinking, and had slept soundly enough with the help of 3 green pills. But her stomach felt queasy. It was still morning, but the sun was too bright. She found herself beginning to sweat after 1 turn around the block. Her feet hurt. 18 years old, and she felt like 40. She would have to stop drinking. Her first opponent was somebody named Foster, with a rating in the 1800s. She would be playing black, but it should be easy, especially if he tried pawn to king 4 and let her get into the Sicilian. Foster seemed calm enough, considering that he was playing the U.S. champion in his first round. He had the good sense not to open with the king pawn against her. He played pawn to queen 4, and she decided to avoid the queen's gambit and try to lead him into unfamiliar territory with the Dutch defense. That meant pawn to king bishop 4. They went through the book moves for a while until somehow she found herself getting into the Stonewall formation. It was a position she did not particularly like, and after she started considering the way the board looked, she began to feel annoyed with herself. The thing to do was break it open and go for Foster's throat. She had just been diddling with him, and she wanted to get this over with. Her head was still aching, and she felt uncomfortable, even in the good swivel chair. There were too many spectators in the room. Foster was a pale blonde in his mid-twenties. He made his moves with a prissy carefulness that was maddening. After the 12th, she looked at the tight position on the board and quickly pushed a center pawn up for sacrifice. She would open up the game and start threatening. She must have a good 600 rating points on this creep. She would wipe him out, get a good lunch and some coffee, and be ready for Goldman or Sizemore in the afternoon. Somehow the pawn sacrifice had been hasty. After Foster took with a knight instead of the pawn she had planned on, she found she had either to defend or to drop another pawn. She bit her lip, annoyed, and looked for something to terrorize him with. But she could find nothing, and her mind was working with a damnable slowness. She retreated a bishop to protect the pawn. Foster raised his eyebrows slightly at that and brought a rook over to the queen file, the one she had opened with her pawn sacrifice. She blinked. She did not like the way this was going. Her headache was getting worse. She got up from the board, went to the director and asked him for aspirin. He found some somewhere, and she took three, chasing them with water from a paper cup, before she went back to Foster. As she walked through the main tournament room, people looked up from their games to stare at her. She was suddenly angry that she had agreed to play in this third-rate tournament, and angry that she had to go back and contend with Foster. She hated the situation. If she beat him, it was meaningless to her, and if he beat her, she would look terrible. But he wouldn't beat her. Benny Watts couldn't beat her, and some prissy graduate student from Louisville wasn't about to drive her into a corner. She would find a combination somewhere and tear him apart with it. But there was no combination to be found. She kept staring at the position as it changed gradually from move to move, and it did not open up for her. Foster was good, clearly better than his ratings showed, but he wasn't that good. The people who filled the little room watched in silence as she went more and more on the defensive, trying to keep her face from showing the alarm that was beginning to dominate her moves. And what was wrong with her mind? She hadn't had a drink for a day and two nights. What was wrong? In the pit of her stomach, she was beginning to feel terrified. If she had somehow damaged her talent? And then, on the 23rd move, Foster began a series of trades in the center of the board, and she found herself unable to stop it, watching her pieces disappear with a sick feeling in her stomach, watching her position become more and more stark in its deterioration. She found herself playing out a lost game, overwhelmed by the two-pawn advantage of a player with a rating of 1,800. There was nothing she could do about it. He would queen a pawn and humiliate her with it. She lifted her king from the board before he could do it and left the room without looking at him, pushing her way through a crowd of people, avoiding their eyes, almost holding her breath, going out into the main room and up to the desk. "I'm feeling ill," she told the director. "I'm going to have to drop out." She walked up Main, heavy-footed and in turmoil, trying not to think about the game. It was horrible. She had allowed this tournament to be a test for her, the kind of rigged test an alcoholic makes for himself, and still, she had failed it. She must not drink when she got home. She must read and play chess and get herself together. But the thought of going to the empty house was frightening. What else could she do? There was nothing she wanted to do and no one to call. The game she had lost was inconsequential, and the tournament was nothing. But the humiliation was overwhelming. She did not want to hear discussions about how she had lost to Foster, did not want to see Foster himself again. She must not drink. She had a real tournament coming up in California in 5 months. What if she had already done it to herself? What if she had shaved away from the surface of her brain whatever synaptic interlacings had formed her gift? She remembered reading somewhere that some pop artist once bought an original drawing by Michelangelo and had taken a piece of art gum and erased it, leaving blank paper. The waste had shocked her. Now she felt a similar shock as she imagined the surface of her own brain with the talent for chess wiped away. At home, she tried a Russian game book, but she couldn't concentrate. She started going through her game with Foster, setting the board up in the kitchen, but the moves of it were too painful. That damned stone wall, and the hastily pushed pawn, a Potzer's move, bad chess, hungover chess. The telephone rang, but she didn't answer. She sat at the board and wished for a moment, painfully, that she had someone to call. Harry Beltic would be back in Louisville, and she didn't want to tell him about the game with Foster. He would find out soon enough. She could call Benny, but Benny had been icy after Paris, and she did not want to talk to him. There was no one else. She got up wearily and opened the cabinet next to the refrigerator, took down a bottle of white wine, and poured herself a glassful. A voice inside her cried out at the outrage, but she ignored it. She drank half of it in one long swallow and stood waiting until she could feel it. Then she finished the glass and poured another. A person could live without chess. Most people did. When she awoke on the sofa the next morning, still wearing the Paris clothes she had worn when losing the game to Foster, she was frightened in a new way. She could sense her brain being physically blurred by alcohol, its positional grasp gone clumsy, its penetration clouded. But after breakfast, she showered and changed, and then poured herself a glass of wine. It was almost mechanical. She had learned to cut off thought as she did it. The main thing was to eat some toast first, so the wine wouldn't burn her stomach. She kept drinking for days, but the memory of the game she had lost and the fear of what she was doing to the sharp edge of her gift would not go away, except when she was so drunk that she could not even think. There was a piece in the Sunday paper about her, with one of the pictures taken that morning at the high school, and a headline reading, "Chess Champ Drops from Tourney." She threw the paper away without reading the article. Then, one morning after a night of dark and confusing dreams, she awoke with an unaccustomed clarity. If she did not stop drinking immediately, she would ruin what she had. She had allowed herself to sink into this frightening murk. She had to find a foothold somewhere to push herself free of it. She would have to get help. With a great sense of relief, she suddenly knew who it was she wanted to get help from. 13. Jolene was not in the Lexington directory. Beth tried information in Louisville and Frankfurt. No Jolene DeWitt. She could have married and changed her name. She could be in Chicago, or the Klondike for that matter. Beth had not seen or heard from her since the day she left Methuen. And there was only one thing to do if she was to go through with this. Her adoption papers were in a drawer in Mrs. Wheatley's desk. She got the folder out and found a letter with the Methuen name and slogan at the top of it in red. The phone number was there. She held the paper nervously for several moments. At the bottom, it was signed in a small, neat hand. Helen Deerdorf, superintendent. It was almost noon, and she had not had a drink yet. For a moment, she thought of steadying herself with a Gibson, but she could not hide the stupidity of that idea from herself. A Gibson would be the end of her resolve. She might be alcoholic, but she was not a fool. She went upstairs and got her bottle of Mexican Librium and took two. Waiting for the tension to ease, she walked into the yard which the boy had mowed the day before. The tea roses had finally bloomed. The petals had fallen from most of them, and at the end of some of the stems were spherical, pregnant-looking hips where the flowers had been. She had never noticed them when they were blooming in June and July. Back in the kitchen, she felt steadier. The tranquilizers were working. How many brain cells did they kill with each milligram? It couldn't be as bad as liquor. She walked into the living room and dialed the Methuen home. The operator at Methuen put her on hold. Beth reached over to the bottle, shook out a green pill, and swallowed it. Finally, the voice came, shockingly crisp, from the receiver.
Helen Deerdorf speaking.
For a moment she couldn't speak, and wanted to hang up. But she sucked in a breath and said,
Mrs. Deerdorf, this is Beth Harmon.
Really?
The voice sounded surprised.
Yes.
Well.
During the pause that followed, it occurred to Beth that Mrs. Deerdorf might have nothing to say. She might find it as difficult talking to Beth as Beth did talking to her.
Well, Mrs. Deerdorf said, we've been reading about you.
How's Mr. Scheibel?
Beth asked.
Mr. Scheibel is still with us. Is that what you called about?
I called about Jolene DeWitt. I need to get in touch with her.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Deerdorf said. Methuen cannot give out the addresses or phone numbers of its charges.
Mrs. Deerdorf,
Beth said, her voice suddenly breaking through into feeling.
Mrs. Deerdorf, do this for me. I have to talk to Jolene.
There are laws,
Mrs. Deerdorf,
Beth said.
Please.
Mrs. Deerdorf's voice took on a different tone.
All right, Elizabeth. DeWitt lives in Lexington. Here's her phone number.
Jesus fucking Christ! Jolene said on the phone. Jesus fucking Christ!
How are you, Jolene?
Beth felt like crying, but she kept the quaver out of her voice.
Oh my God, child! Jolene said, laughing. It's so good to hear your voice.
Are you still ugly?
Are you still black?
I am one black lady, Jolene said. And you've lost your ugly. I saw you in more magazines than Barbara Streisand, my famous friend.
Why didn't you call?
Jealous?
Jolene, Beth said. Did you ever get adopted?
Shit, no. I graduated from that place. Why in hell didn't you mail me a card or a box of cookies?
I'll buy you dinner tonight. Can you get to Toby's on Main Street at 7?
I'll cut a class, Jolene said. Son of a bitch! U.S. champion at the historic game of chess. A genuine winner.
That's what I want to talk about, Beth said.
When they met at Toby's, the spontaneity was gone. Beth had spent the day without a drink, had her hair cut at Roberta's, and cleaned up the kitchen, almost overcome with the excitement of talking to Jolene again. She arrived at Toby's a quarter of an hour early, and nervously turned down the waiter's offer to bring her a drink. She had a Coke in front of her when Jolene arrived. At first, Beth didn't recognize her. The woman who came toward her table in what looked like a Coco Chanel suit and a full bushy afro was so tall that Beth could not believe it was Jolene. She looked like a movie star or a rock and roll princess, fuller in the figure than Diana Ross and as cool as Lena Horne. But when Beth saw that it was in fact Jolene, that the smile and the eyes were the Jolene she remembered, she stood up awkwardly. And they embraced.
Jolene's perfume was strong. Beth felt self-conscious. Jolene patted her back while they hugged and said, "Beth Harmon, old Beth." They sat down and looked at each other awkwardly. Beth decided she had to have a drink to see her through this. But when the waiter came, blessedly breaking the silence, Jolene ordered a club soda, and Beth had him bring her another Coke. Jolene was carrying something in a manila envelope, which she set on the table in front of Beth. Beth picked it up. It was a book, and she knew immediately what it was. She slipped off the envelope. Modern Chess Openings, her old, nearly worn-out copy. "Me all the time," Jolene said. "Pissed at you for being adopted." Beth grimaced, opening the book to the title page where the childish handwriting read, "Elizabeth Harmon, Methuen Home." "What about for being white?" "Who could forget?" Jolene said. Beth looked at Jolene's good, beautiful face, with all the remarkable hair and the long black eyelashes and the full lips, and the self-consciousness dropped away from her with a relief that was physical in its simplicity. She smiled broadly. "It's good to see you." What she wanted to say was, "I love you." During the first half of the meal, Jolene talked about Methuen, about sleeping through chapel and hating the food, and about Mr. Shell, Miss Graham, and the Saturday Christian movies. She was hilarious on the subject of Mrs. Deerdorf, imitating her tight voice and her way of tossing her head. She ate slowly and laughed a lot, and Beth found herself laughing with her. It had been a long time since Beth had laughed, and she had never felt so easy with anyone, not even with Mrs. Wheatley. Jolene ordered a glass of white wine with her veal, and Beth hesitated before asking the waiter for ice water. "You're not old enough?" Jolene said. "That's not it. I'm 18. Jolene raised her eyebrows and went back to her veal. After a few moments, she started talking again. "When you went off to your happy home, I started doing serious volleyball. I graduated when I was 18, and the university gave me a scholarship in phys ed." "How do you like it?" "It's all right," Jolene said, a bit fast, and then, "No, it isn't. It's a shuck, is what it is. I don't want to be a gym coach."
"You could do something else."
Jolene shook her head.
"It wasn't till I got my bachelor's last year that I really caught on."
She had been talking with her mouth full. Now she swallowed and leaned forward with her elbows on the table. "I should have been in law or government. These are the right days for what I've got, and I blew it on learning the side straddle hop and the major muscles of the abdomen." Her voice got lower and stronger. "I'm a black woman. I'm an orphan. I ought to be at Harvard. I ought to be getting my picture in Time magazine like you."
"You'd look great with Barbara Walters," Beth said. "You could talk to her about the emotional deprivation of orphans."
"Could I ever?" Jolene said. "I'd like to tell about Helen Deerdorf and her goddamn tranquilizers."
Beth hesitated a moment. Then she said, "Do you still take tranquilizers?"
"No," Jolene said. "Hell no." She laughed. "Never forget you ripping off that whole jarful. Right there in the multi-purpose room in front of the whole fucking orphanage, with old Helen ready to turn into a pillar of salt, and the rest of us with our jaws hanging slack."
She laughed again.
"Made you a hero, it did. I told the new ones about it after you was gone."
Jolene had finished her meal. She sat back from the table now and pushed the plate toward the center. Then she leaned back, took a package of Kent's from her jacket pocket, and looked at it for a moment. "When your picture came out in Life, I was the one put it on the bulletin board in the library. Still there, as far as I know."
She lit a cigarette, using a little black lighter, and inhaled deeply. A girl Mozart startles the world at chess. My, my.
I still take tranquilizers, Beth said. Too many of them.
Oh, you poor thing, Jolene said wryly, looking at her cigarette.
Beth was quiet for a while. The silence between them was palpable. Then she said, Let's have dessert.
Chocolate mousse, Jolene said.
During dessert, she stopped eating and looked across the table.
You don't look good, Beth, she said. You're puffy.
Beth nodded and finished her mousse. Jolene drove her home in her silver VW. When they got to Janwell, Beth said, I'd like you to come in for a while, Jolene. I want you to see my house.
Sure, Jolene said.
Beth showed her where to pull over, and when they got out of the car, Jolene said,
That whole house belonged to you?
And Beth said, Yes.
Jolene laughed. You're no orphan, she said. Not anymore.
But when they came into the little entryway inside the front door, the stale, fruity smell was a shock. Beth had not noticed it before. There was an embarrassed silence while she turned on the lamps in the living room and looked around. She had not seen the dust on the TV screen or the stains on the cobbler's bench. At the corner of the living room ceiling near the staircase was a dense cobweb. The whole place was dark and musty. Jolene walked around the room, looking.
You've been doing more than pills, honey, she said.
I've been drinking wine.
I believe it.
Beth made them coffee in the kitchen. At least the floor in there was clean. She opened the window out into the garden to let fresh air in. Her chessboard was still set up on the table, and Jolene picked up the white queen and held it for a moment.
I get tired of games, she said. Never did learn this one.
Want me to teach you?
Jolene laughed. It'd be something to tell about.
She set the queen back on the board.
They've instructed me in handball, racquetball, and paddleball. I play tennis, golf, dodgeball, and I wrestle. Don't need chess. What I want to hear about is all this wine.
Beth handed her a mug of coffee. Jolene set it down and got out a cigarette. Sitting in the drab kitchen with her bright navy suit and her afro, she was like a new center in the room.
It start with the pills? Jolene asked.
I used to love them, Beth said. Really love them. Jolene shook her head twice from side to side. I haven't had anything to drink today, Beth said abruptly. I'm supposed to play in Russia next year.
Luchenko, Jolene said. Borgov.
Beth was surprised that she knew the names. I'm scared of it.
Then don't go.
If I don't, there's nothing else for me to do. I'll just drink.
Looks like you do that anyway.
I just need to quit drinking and quit those pills and fix this place up. Look at the grease on that stove. She pointed to it. I've got to study chess 8 hours a day, and I've got to do some tournaments. They want me to play in San Francisco, and they want me on The Tonight Show. I should do all that.
Jolene studied her.
What I want is a drink, Beth said.
If you weren't here, I'd have a bottle of wine.
Jolene frowned.
You sound like Susan Hayward in those movies, she said.
It's no movie, Beth said.
Then quit talking like one. Let me tell you what to do. You come over to the alumni gymnasium on Euclid Avenue tomorrow morning at 10. That's when I work out. Bring your gym clothes and a pair of shorts. You need to get that puffy look out of you before you make any more plans.
Beth stared at her.
I always hated Jim.
I remember, Jolene said.
Beth thought about it. There were bottles of red wine and white in the cabinet behind her, and for a moment, she became impatient for Jolene to leave so that she could get one out and twist the cork off and pour herself a full glass. She could feel the sensation of it at the back of her throat.
It's not that bad, Jolene said. I'll get you a couple of fresh towels and you can use my hair dryer.
I don't know how to get there.
Take a cab. Hell, walk.
Beth looked at her, dismayed.
You've got to get your ass moving, girl, Jolene said. You got to quit sitting in your own funk.
Okay, Beth said. I'll be there. When Jolene left, Beth had one glass of wine, but not a second. She opened up all the windows in the house and drank the wine out in the backyard, with the moon, nearly full, directly above the little shed at the back. There was a cool breeze. She took a long time over the drink, letting the breeze blow into the kitchen window, fluttering the curtains, blowing through the kitchen and living room, clearing out the air inside. The gym was a high-ceilinged room with white walls. Light came in from enormous windows along the side, where a row of strange-looking machines sat. Jolene was wearing yellow tights and gym shoes. The morning was warm, and Beth had worn her white shorts in the taxi. At the far end of the exercise room, a doleful-looking young man in gray trunks lay on his back on a bench, pushing up weights and groaning. Otherwise, they were alone. They started with a pair of stationary bicycles. Jolene set the drag on Beth's at 10 and 60 for her own. By the time they had pedaled 10 minutes, Beth was covered with sweat and her calves were aching.
It gets worse, Jolene said.
Beth gritted her teeth and kept pedaling. She could not get the rhythm right on the hip and back machine, and her ass slid on the imitation leather bench she had to lie on while she pushed the weights down with her legs. Jolene had set it for 40 pounds, but even that seemed too much. Then there was the machine where she raised the weights with her ankles, making the tendons in her upper legs stand out and hurt. After that, she had to sit upright in what reminded her of an electric chair and pull in weights with her elbows.
Firm up your pectorals, Jolene said.
I thought that was a kind of fish, Beth said.
Jolene laughed.
Trust me, honey, this is what you need.
Beth did them all, furious and terribly out of breath. It made her fury worse to see that Jolene used far heavier weights than she did. But then, Jolene's figure was perfect. The shower afterward was exquisite. There were strong water jets, and Beth sprayed herself hard, getting the sweat off. She soaped herself thoroughly and watched the foam swirl on the white tiles at her feet as she rinsed it off with a stinging hot spray. The woman at the cafeteria was handing Beth a plate with Salisbury steak on it when Jolene pushed her tray up next to Beth's.
None of that, Jolene said.
She took the plate and handed it back.
No gravy, she said, and no potatoes.
I'm not overweight, Beth said. It won't hurt me to eat potatoes.
Jolene said nothing. When they pushed their trays past the jello and Bavarian cream pie, Jolene shook her head.
You ate chocolate mousse last night, Beth said.
Last night was special, Jolene said. This is today.
They had lunch at 11:30 because Jolene had a 12 o'clock class. When Beth asked her what it was, Jolene said,
Eastern Europe in the 20th century.
Is that part of phys ed?
Beth asked.
I didn't tell all of it yesterday. I'm getting an MS in political science.
Beth stared at her.
On y sait qui mal y pense, Jolene said.
When Beth got up the next morning, her back and calves were sore
and she decided not to go to the gym. But when she opened the refrigerator to find something for breakfast, she saw stacks of TV dinners and suddenly thought of the way Mrs. Wheatley's pale legs had looked when she rolled down her stockings. She shook her head in revulsion and started prying the boxes loose. The thought of frozen fried chicken and roast beef and turkey made her ill. She dumped them all in a plastic shopping bag. When she opened the cabinet to look over the canned foods, there were three bottles of Almaden Mountain Rhine sitting in front of the cans. She hesitated and closed the door. She would think about that later. She had toast and black coffee for breakfast. On her way to the gym, she dropped the sack of frozen dinners into the garbage. At lunch, Jolene told her about a bulletin board in the student union that listed students who would do unskilled work at $2 an hour. Jolene walked her over on the way to class, and Beth took down two numbers. By 3 o'clock that afternoon, she had a business administration major beating the carpets in the backyard and an art history major scrubbing the refrigerator and kitchen cabinets. Beth did not supervise them. She spent the time working out variations in the Nimzo Indian defense. By the next Monday, she was using all seven of the Nautilus machines and doing sit-ups afterward. On Wednesday, Jolene added 10 pounds to each of them for her and had her hold a 5-pound weight on her chest when she did the sit-ups. The week after that, they started playing handball. Beth was awkward at it and got out of breath quickly. Jolene beat her badly. Beth kept at it doggedly, panting and sweating and sometimes bruising the palm of her hand on the little black ball. It took her 10 days and a few lucky bounces before she won her first game.
"I knew you'd start winning soon enough," Jolene said.
They stood in the center of the court, sweating.
"I hate losing," Beth said.
That day, there was a letter waiting for her from something called Christian Crusade. The stationery had about 20 names down the side, under an embossed cross. The letter read, "Dear Miss Harmon, as we have been unable to reach you by telephone, we are writing to determine your interest in the support of Christian Crusade in your forthcoming competition in the USSR. Christian Crusade is a non-profit organization dedicated to the opening of closed doors to the message of Christ. We have found your career as a trainee of a Christian institution, the Methuen Home, noteworthy. We would like to help in your forthcoming struggle, since we share your Christian ideals and aspirations. If you are interested in our support, please contact us at our offices in Houston. Yours in Christ, Crawford Walker, Director, Christian Crusade, Foreign Division." She almost threw the letter away, until she remembered Benny's saying that he had been given money for his Russian trip by a church group. She had Benny's phone number on a folded piece of paper in her chest clock box. She got it out and dialed. Benny answered after the third ring.
"Hi," she said. "It's Beth."
Benny was a bit cool, but when she told him about the letter, he said at once, "Take it. They're loaded." "Would they pay for my ticket to Russia?"
"More than that. If you ask them, they'll send me over with you. Separate rooms, considering their views."
"Why would they pay so much money?"
"They want us to beat the communists for Jesus. They're the ones who paid part of my way 2 years ago."
He paused.
"Are you coming back to New York?"
His voice was carefully neutral. "I need to stay in Kentucky a while longer. I'm working out in a gym, and I've entered a tournament in California."
"Sure," Benny said. "It sounds all right to me."
She wrote Christian Crusade that afternoon to say that she was very much interested in their offer and would like to take Benjamin Watts with her as a second. She used the pale blue stationery, crossing out Mrs. Alston Wheatley at the top, and writing in Elizabeth Harmon. When she walked to the corner to mail the letter, she decided to go on downtown and buy new sheets and pillowcases for the bed and a new tablecloth for the kitchen.
The winter light in San Francisco was remarkable. She had never seen anything quite like it before. It gave the buildings a preternatural clarity of line, and when she climbed to the top of Telegraph Hill and looked back, she caught her breath at the sharp focus of the houses and hotels that line the long, steep street, and below them, the perfect blue of the bay. There was a flower stand at the corner, and she bought a bunch of marigolds. Looking back at the bay, she saw a young couple a block away climbing toward her. They were clearly out of breath and stopped to rest. Beth realized with surprise that the climb had been easy for her. She decided to take long walks during her week there. Maybe she could find a gym somewhere. When she walked up the hill to the tournament in the morning, the air was still splendid and the colors bright. But she was tense. The elevator in the big hotel was crowded. Several people in it stared at her, and she looked away nervously. The man at the desk stopped what he was doing the minute she walked up. "Do I register here?" she asked.
"No need, Miss Harmon. Just go on in."
"Which board?" He raised his eyebrows.
"Board one."
Board one was in a room by itself. The table was on a 3-foot-high platform, and a display board as big as a home movie screen stood behind it. On each side of the table was a big swivel chair of brown leather and chrome. It was 5 minutes before starting time, and the room was jammed with people. She had to push her way through them to the playing space. As she did so, the buzz of talk died down. Everyone looked at her. When she climbed the steps to the platform, they began to applaud. She tried not to let her face show anything, but she was frightened. The last game of chess she had played was 5 months before, and she had lost it. She didn't even know who her opponent was. She hadn't thought to ask. She sat there for a moment with her mind nearly empty, and then an arrogant-looking young man came briskly through the crowd and up the steps. He had long black hair and a broad, drooping mustache. She recognized him from somewhere, and when he introduced himself as Andy Levitt, she remembered the name from Chess Review. He seated himself stiffly. A tournament director came up to the table and spoke quietly to Levitt.
"You can start her clock now."
Levitt reached out, looking unconcerned, and pressed the button on Beth's clock. She held herself steady and played her queen's pawn, keeping her eyes on the board. By the time they had got into the middle game, there were people jammed in the doorway, and someone was shushing the crowd and trying to maintain order. She had never seen so many spectators at a match. She turned her attention back to the board and carefully brought a rook to an open file. If Levitt didn't find a way to prevent it, she could try attacking in 3 moves. If she wasn't missing something in the position. She started moving in on him cautiously, prying the pawns loose from his castled king. Then she took a deep breath and brought a rook to the 7th rank. She could hear it at the back of her mind, the voice of the chess bum in Cincinnati years before.
"Bone in the throat. A rook on the 7th rank.
She looked across the board at Levitt. He looked as if it were indeed a chicken bone and deeply embedded. Something in her exulted, seeing him try to hide his confusion. And when she followed the rook with her queen, looking brutal on the 7th rank, he resigned immediately. The applause in the room was loud and enthusiastic. When she came down from the platform, she was smiling. There were people waiting with old copies of Chess Review, wanting her to autograph her picture on the cover. Others wanted her to sign their programs or just sheets of paper. While she was signing one of the magazines, she looked for a moment at the black-and-white photograph of herself holding the big trophy in Ohio, with Benny and Barnes and a few others out of focus in the background. Her face looked tired and plain, and she recalled with a sudden remembered shame that the magazine had sat with its tan mailing cover in a stack on the cobbler's bench for a month before she had opened it and found her picture.
Someone thrust another copy at her to sign, and she shook off the memory. She autographed her way out of the crowded room and through yet another crowd that was waiting outside the door, filling the space between her playing area and the ballroom, where the rest of the tournament was still in progress. Two directors were trying to hush the crowd to avoid disturbing the other games as she came through. Some of the players looked up from their boards angrily and frowned in her direction. It was exhilarating and frightening, having all these people pressed near her, pushing up to her with admiration. One of the women who had got her autograph said, "I don't know a thing about chess, dear, but I'm thrilled for you." And a middle-aged man insisted on shaking her hand, saying, "You're the best thing for the game since Capablanca." "Thanks," she said. "I wish it were as easy for me." Maybe it is, she thought. Her brain seemed to be all right. Maybe she hadn't ruined it. She walked confidently down the street to her hotel in bright sunshine. She would be going to Russia in 6 months. Christian Crusade had agreed to buy tickets on Aeroflot for her and Benny, and a woman from the USCF, and would pay their hotel bills. The Moscow tournament would provide the meals. She had been studying chess for 6 hours a day, and she could keep it up. She stopped to buy more flowers, carnations, this time. The woman at the desk had asked for her autograph last night when she came in from dinner. She would be glad to get her another vase. Before leaving for California, Beth had mailed off checks for subscriptions to all the magazines Benny took. She would be getting Deutsche Schachzeitung, the oldest chess magazine, and British chess magazine, and from Russia, Shakhmatny versus USSR. There would be eShake Europe, an American chess bulletin. She planned to play through every Grandmaster game in them, and when she found games that were important, she would memorize them and analyze every move that had consequence, or developed any idea that she was not familiar with. In early spring, she might go to New York and play the U.S. Open and get in a few weeks with Benny. The flowers in her hand glowed crimson. Her new jeans and cotton sweater felt fresh on her skin in the cool San Francisco air. At the bottom of the street, the blue ocean lay like a dream of possibility. Her soul sang silently with it, reaching out toward the Pacific. When she came home with her trophy and the first prize check, she found in the pile of mail two business envelopes. One was from the USCF and contained a check for $400 and a brief apology that they couldn't send more. The second was from Christian Crusade. It had a 3-page letter that spoke of the need to promote international understanding through Christian principles and to annihilate communism for the advancement of those same principles. The word "his" was capitalized in a way that made Beth uneasy. The letter was signed "Yours in Christ" by four people. Folded up in it was a check for $4,000. She held the check in her hand for a long time. Her prize money at San Francisco was $2,000, and she had to take her travel expenses out of it. Her bank account had been dwindling for the past 6 months. She had hoped to get at most $2,000 from the people in Texas. Whatever crazy ideas they might have, the money was a gift from heaven. She called Benny to tell him the good news. When she came in from her Wednesday morning squash game, the phone was ringing. She got her raincoat off in a hurry, threw it on the sofa, and picked up the phone. It was a woman's voice.
"Is this Elizabeth Harmon?"
"Yes."
"This is Helen Deardorff, at Methuen."
She was too astonished to speak.
"I have something to tell you, Elizabeth. Mr. Scheibel died last night. I thought you might want to know."
She had a sudden image of the fat old janitor bent over his chess set in the basement, with the bare light bulb over his head, and herself standing by him, watching